KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The question is preposterous. How can I smuggle a terrorist into the United States?
President Trump meets with the president of El Salvador, who says he will not return a wrongly deported man to the U.S.
Today is Monday, April 14th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. As trade tensions mount, President Trump is calling on European countries to buy more American chicken.
If U.S. producers really want to compete with Europe, they should think about elevating their food safety practices.
And while the trade war escalates between Washington and Beijing, China's leader Xi Jinping begins a tour of Southeast Asia.
And the band OK Go releases its first album in a decade.
This is the closest I've ever felt to, like, our flag was planted a long time ago, so we don't have anything we need to prove to anyone or show to anyone.
Those stories after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Another pro-Palestinian protest organizer has been detained by immigration officials. Mohsen Madawi was an organizer at Columbia University's protest last year. He was detained by officials after arriving for an immigration appointment. More from NPR's Jasmine Garves.
Mohsen Madawi was born and raised in a refugee camp in the West Bank and moved to the U.S. in 2014. He'd recently gotten his BA and was planning to enroll at Columbia for a master's degree in international affairs. He has a green card. His lawyers say he believed he was arriving to an immigration appointment that would bring him closer to becoming a U.S. citizen. He is detained at an immigration center in Colchester, Vermont. A judge has granted his lawyer's request for a temporary restraining order to prevent federal officials from transferring him to a more conservative jurisdiction, which is what has happened to several other college demonstrators who've been arrested. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
Democratic lawmakers say big cuts to Medicaid proposed by many Republican lawmakers could end treatment for hundreds of thousands of people struggling with fentanyl addiction. The report found care for people in low-income areas would be especially hard hit. More from NPR's Brian Mann.
Republicans are pushing for deep budget cuts that many experts say will shrink Medicaid, the biggest source of insurance coverage in the U.S. for people seeking treatment for fentanyl and other forms of addiction. A report issued by Democrats serving on Congress's Joint Economic Committee found hundreds of thousands of people now receiving drug treatment through Medicaid won't qualify for other forms of coverage. A separate study by the Brookings Institution found the loss of Medicaid funding could also hit many hospitals and clinics, especially in low-income rural and urban areas. This comes at a time when drug overdose deaths have been dropping, experts say in part because of access to affordable treatment. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
The head of tech giant Meta, Mark Zuckerberg, faced questions on the witness stand at the first day of a high-stakes antitrust trial. The FTC case focusing on whether the company broke any competition laws. More from NPR's Bobby Allen.
Well, so far, a lawyer for the Federal Trade Commission is going over Meta's early history. Zuckerberg said from the witness stand that he rejected advice early on that he should sell the company because it just wouldn't be able to compete with MySpace. That was the advice way back when. Zuckerberg then described launching Facebook's newsfeed in 2006. And from there, Zuckerberg explained the rationale behind various product updates to Facebook. The day ended by Zuckerberg being grilled about when Meta started thinking about acquiring Instagram, having him read old emails about this. And this is all setting the foundation for the FTC's case, which is expected to get a lot more juicy tomorrow.
NPR's Bobby Allen was in the courtroom today. Meta is an NPR sponsor. You're listening to NPR. While some prominent tech sector heads have embraced the policies of the Trump administration that has put bosses at odds in some cases with their employees, many of the traditionally liberal employees of the big tech firms increasingly say they are feeling disillusioned with the direction the industry is going. And even in the case of those tech sector leaders who are not publicly backing the president, many have gone out of their way not to antagonize him. Most Americans don't eat enough vegetables, but a new food hack on TikTok makes it extremely simple. It's called Dinosaur Time. Sarah Bowden reports all you need are some plain leafy greens.
With Dinosaur Time, you take a big handful of greens, give them a rinse, and then shove them in your mouth. Humans have been chomping on leafy greens for millennia. But one of the first people to do this on TikTok seems to be a former science teacher named Amy Garrett. She has 50,000 followers. She says she likes veggies, but making them taste good takes time.
And instead of feeling guilty about not eating vegetables, I'm just going to stuff them down my face and then eat what I normally would have eaten without any guilt.
Garrett adds that dinosaur time is not a meal replacement or a way to lose weight. It's a strategy to add nutrition to your diet. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Bowden.
A group of five Frenchmen and a Belgian woman who apparently sought to climb the famous cathedral in Cologne are now in custody. German police saying they were alerted by private security guards with the church who spotted the group with headlamps on climbing the building. Climbers were seeking to scale the cathedral. In the middle of the night, police in riot gear arrived. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump met with his counterpart from El Salvador today, President Nayib Bukele. It was a high-profile meeting because right now Bukele is imprisoning hundreds of immigrants deported from the U.S. And one of those people being held in El Salvador is Kilmar Abrego Garcia, a Maryland man deported by mistake. The Supreme Court has said that the White House has to facilitate his return to the U.S. NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben joins us now with more. Hi, Danielle.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so the biggest question looming over this whole meeting was the fate of Kilmar Abrego Garcia. He's a Salvadorian immigrant who entered the U.S. illegally. And Danielle, he had been given legal protections by an immigration judge, but he remains deported to El Salvador anyway. So what did Bukele say about all of this?
Well, he said flat out, no, there are no plans to send Abrego Garcia back to Maryland, which has been his home for around 15 years. Here's how Bukele put it.
The question is preposterous. How can I smuggle a terrorist into the United States? I don't have the power to return him to the United States.
Now, on that terrorist point, the Trump administration says that Abrego Garcia is a member of MS-13. That's a gang the administration has declared a terrorist organization. But back in 2019, a judge ruled that there was insufficient evidence to deport him. But again, the Supreme Court has ruled days ago that Abrego Garcia is owed due process and that the administration has to facilitate his return to the U.S. But Bukele has cooperated very willingly with Trump in housing deportees, even ones that are not from El Salvador. Last month, the administration deported more than 200 people whom they claimed were dangerous gang members from Venezuela.
Okay, so we're hearing what Bukele is saying, but what did Trump and his team say about all this?
Well, when a CNN reporter tried to ask Trump about why he's not going along with the Supreme Court, he was dismissive.
How long do we have to answer this question from you? Why don't you just say, isn't it wonderful that we're keeping criminals out of our country? Why can't you just say that? Why do you go over and over? And that's why nobody watches you anymore. You know, you have no credibility.
He also called on a number of his officials who were also in the Oval at the time, like Attorney General Pam Bondi, also Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller, asking them to back him up. And Miller argued that Abrego Garcia is a Salvadoran citizen and that the president has power over foreign affairs. But again, the Supreme Court has ruled that Abrego Garcia should get due process and that he should be returned.
I mean, we're not only talking about Abrego Garcia. Bukele has taken in all these deported people into a pretty notorious mega prison, right? Did anything come out of today's meeting about the future of that arrangement using that prison?
Yes. Trump again brought up something he's been suggesting for months now, the possibility of deporting U.S. citizens to El Salvador, what he calls homegrown criminals. Here's a clip from a live feed that Bukele broadcast on social media, and this is Trump talking to Bukele as they entered the Oval Office.
I said, homegrowns are next. The homegrowns. You got to build about five more places.
Yeah, that's fair.
All right.
And Trump also suggested there that Bukele build five more places, seeming to mean to build more prisons to house U.S. deportees. And that laughter you heard is people who were in the Oval, who included Trump's team. Now, later in the event, Trump again said he and his team are studying the laws about this possibility, saying he wants it to be violent people sent to El Salvador. But many legal scholars have said this would be blatantly unconstitutional to deport U.S. citizens, whether or not they're violent.
That is NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben. Thank you so much, Danielle.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, staying with immigration, the Trump administration is urging immigrants across the country to self-deport.
President Trump has a clear message for those that are in our country illegally. Leave now. If you don't, we will find you and we will deport you. You will never return.
That is Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem in an ad campaign that's been running on English and Spanish language media. It has led to conversations among immigrant families about whether to stay or go, and in many cases, what parents should do with their American-born children. NPR's Jasmine Garst spent time with some of those families.
It's nighttime in Durham, North Carolina. Sitting at the kitchen table, S sighs when she recalls the first few weeks of the Trump administration. S is her first initial. Like all of the immigrants NPR spoke with for this story, she is without legal status and asks that we not use her full name.
Me sentía muy angustiada. No sentía ganas de hacer nada.
I felt so anguished, she says. I didn't want to do anything in the house, just sleep and wake up to find out it was all a dream. Her husband, Jose, reaches across the table to hold her hand. In the living room, the kids' cartoons are blasting. They are among the around 10 million mixed status families in the U.S. Their kids are American citizens. And so for the past few months, while the children sleep, they've been staying up at night debating whether they should all go back to El Salvador. In the meantime,
me di cuenta de que muchos padres latinos fueron a solicitar el pasaporte.
Jose says a lot of Latino parents have been getting their children American passports so that the kids can come back to the U.S. He says, we decided to do the same. Trisha McLaughlin, Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security, tells NPR that self-deportation is a pillar of the Trump administration's immigration policy.
This is going to put them in a much better position if they leave now. They don't have to be arrested. They don't have to be detained. And they could potentially come back to the country legally the right way and come and live the American dream.
As of now, the administration has not said how or when they could return. But NPR has spoken to dozens of immigrant families who say they are discussing the possibility of self-deporting. Life in the U.S., they say, has just gotten too scary. On a sunny Saturday in Maryland, a woman named Mari is singing a lullaby to get her baby to sleep. She and her husband are from Guatemala. They have been here for over a decade. He's a roofer. She's a homemaker. The kids are American citizens. Mari says her six-year-old daughter, Elle, has been having a hard time with the new reality. She recently started having panic attacks at school.
Sí, lloraba mucho.
She says Elle cried a lot. She was worried about the immigration crackdowns. Elle, who is sitting with us, tells me she wants to be a mathematician when she grows up.
I love science too. The stars and the animals.
With mom's permission, I ask Elle how she's been feeling lately. She's been having really bad stomach aches. She's sad.
I was just feeling sad. My mom told me it's gonna be okay. I worry too something will happen to her. Like something won't get her. Like immigration is taking persons to the state when they grew up.
Mari says her husband wants to go back to Guatemala right now. He says if the situation here keeps devolving, we're going to have to get the kids their American passports. We can't live like this. But Mari doesn't want to leave. She says her children were born here. It's led to arguments, and that's exacerbated Elle's anxiety. So for now, they've been telling her a different story.
Mami, le digo yo, si esto empeora, pues vamos a ir, no vamos a ir a vacacionar.
Baby, if things keep getting worse, we're going to go on a vacation. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, Maryland.
President Trump wants countries to buy more American chicken. That's just one of the issues to surface in an escalating global trade war. NPR's Will Stone explains why.
For decades, Europe has been at odds with the U.S. over chicken, and politicians overseas are not jumping at President Trump's challenge. Here's what Darren Jones, chief secretary to the U.K.'s Treasury, had to say recently during an interview on Sky News.
I think we can get a good deal on both sides.
You can't both have chlorinated chicken and not have chlorinated chicken.
And I've been really clear that we are not having chlorinated chicken in the UK.
That's right, chlorinated chicken. It's become a sort of buzzword over the years. In the late 90s, the European Union placed a ban on poultry meat that had been rinsed with disinfectants, including chlorine. Using chlorine was once common in the U.S. for preventing sources of foodborne illness like salmonella and campylobacter. But it turns out times have changed.
The vast majority of chicken processed in the United States is not chilled in chlorine and hasn't been for quite a few years.
Diana Barassa is an applied poultry microbiologist at Auburn University. She says now poultry processors primarily use an organic acid known as peroxyacetic or peracetic acid, basically a mixture of vinegar and hydrogen peroxide.
It extends shelf life. It very significantly reduces the number of bacteria on chicken carcasses.
This has let the U.S. export poultry to other countries that prohibit chlorine, but not the EU and UK. They don't allow any chemical washing. While it may be a perception issue for consumers, the chemicals themselves are not the primary concern. Regulators in Europe and the U.S. have concluded they don't pose a danger. Sarah Sorcher says it's more what those chemicals represent.
Are these really a band-aid that's covering up some deeper issues with the food safety practices in the industry?
Sorcher is with the consumer advocacy group, the Center for Science in the Public Interest.
Our hygiene practices are essentially, in their minds, inadequate.
And she thinks Europe has a point here.
If U.S. producers really want to compete with Europe, they should think about elevating their food safety practices.
But others in this field disagree. Byron D. Chavez is a food microbiologist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
I would be very cautious about pushing that narrative.
He says fundamentally, the regulations are different. Europe relies on pre-harvest interventions.
Pre-harvest means when the animal is still alive. Things like vaccination and different types of additives that are used in feed.
The U.S., on the other hand, focuses more on interventions after the chicken is slaughtered. Chavez says it's difficult to compare the U.S. and Europe on foodborne illnesses linked to poultry because of differences in how the data are collected. His view?
The bottom line is that salmonella and campylobacter continue to be significant foodborne pathogens on both sides of the ocean.
Neither approach, he says, is 100% effective at eliminating this risk. Will Stone, NPR News.
And you're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at CySimsFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. China's leader Xi Jinping has arrived in Vietnam. It's the first stop in a tour of Southeast Asia. The visit comes after days of escalations in the trade war between Beijing and Washington. Adam Hancock reports from Singapore.
Vietnam has rolled out the red carpet for President Xi Jinping. The Chinese leader arrived in Hanoi on Monday, kicking off a tour to three countries that are all targets of President Trump's tariffs. Whilst this visit has been planned for weeks, its timing couldn't be better for Beijing. Here's Nguyen Gac Xiang from the think tank ISIS Yusof Ishak Institute in Singapore.
I think it's a very good chance for President Xi Jinping himself to present that China is a responsible stakeholder and is willing to hold the global rules by order.
Xi's arrival comes at a difficult time for Vietnam. The country was left stunned when Washington announced it would face 46% import tariffs before the White House reduced it to 10% for 90 days last week. The manufacturing powerhouse is heavily reliant on exports to the world's largest economy and is now trying to negotiate President Trump's levies down. At the same time, Vietnam also wants to keep neighbouring China on their side.
Xi Jinping's decision to travel to Southeast Asia is very significant.
This is Susanna Patton, director of the Southeast Asia programme at the Lowy Institute in Sydney.
He rarely makes bilateral visits to the region, and so his decision to go there now definitely suggests that China sees this as being the right time to advance its interests in each of the three countries.
After his stop in Vietnam, Xi will head to Malaysia, the current chair of ASEAN. The 10-nation bloc was the biggest recipient of Chinese exports last year, receiving nearly $600 billion worth of goods. Whilst this trip is being seen as a charm offensive by China, Patton isn't expecting any major announcements.
China's development finance to the region has been tapering away, so big new deals would really go against the trend.
President Xi's tour will continue against the backdrop of the escalating China-US tit-for-tat. Before arriving in Vietnam, the Chinese leader said that there will be no winners in a trade war. The trouble for Beijing, though, is that Trump has reduced the hefty global tariffs to 10%, except for China. That's left officials there scrambling to find support and avoid being the only ones left out in the cold. For NPR News, I'm Adam Hancock in Singapore.
Put Damian Kulash and Tim Nordwind in a room together and you can tell they've been friends for decades.
So now we sit in the sound booth, smiling.
Trying to drop truth.
Loving Charlie Brown and Snoop.
You want some science? Because here's proof.
This went on for a while as we had some technical difficulties connecting their studio in Culver City with mine in D.C.
Hello.
Hey.
Hello.
Oh, you can hear me. Great. Amazing.
Ari.
Hi.
Ari. Hi, Ari.
Hi. I now know what it sounds like if OK Go tries freestyle rap, and I don't know that I would encourage you to move in that direction.
Challenge accepted.
Yeah, really. How are we supposed to get
for
better?
Your next album? I wanted to talk to Kulash and Nordwind, the founding members of OK Go, about their current album called And the Adjacent Possible. It's the band's fifth, and their first in more than a decade. I wish I could say it would all be all right. I started by asking them what it was like to get back into the studio after so long.
I remember feeling kind of burnt out and spent from the several years of touring and video making that we had done in the past, and the basic idea that we had to kind of counteract that was, let's get back in the studio. We love being in the studio. We love writing music. Let's just remember what that feels like. And so I remember just feeling almost relief to be back in with Damian and writing again.
We've also, we didn't mean for it to be so long.
That's true.
All of our records have been spaced out more than you would plan if you were trying to run a good career, because we make these elaborate videos which take months, and we tour for months on end, and we're not the quickest writers in the world. But all of that was compounded this time by Andy, our guitarist, and I both had children, and neither of us wanted to be away from home when they were, you know, in their infant and toddler years. And then there was this pandemic, which you probably heard about, and you wind up on the other side going, like, where did a decade go?
When I meet up with people who I've been friends with for 30 years, sometimes we sort of revert a little bit. Is that your dynamic? How would you describe the way you all relate to each other?
I would say that the Tim and I have never progressed, so there's nothing right. to revert to. Okay. We met when we were 11 at an arts summer camp called Interlaken, and he was there for theater and I was there for visual art. And
interesting that neither of you was there for music.
We got it wrong even then.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. I actually did start going for violin, but I didn't have the patience for all the practice, and I realized that I loved painting and drawing more. And so I was painting and drawing, and that actually is sort of my way into music, was wearing headphones while I was painting.
Wow. Tim, what do you remember about that 11-year-old meeting?
Oh, gosh, I remember I really needed it. I was so homesick. It was a two-month-long camp, and Damien was my first real friend that I made there.
Only one since?
And basically, only one since. I do remember, even though neither one of us were really musicians at the time, we certainly bonded over our love of music, especially the musical Les Mis. It was like Les Mis, Run DMC.
Pretty in Pink soundtrack.
Pretty in Pink soundtrack.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I remember most is us just talking about feelings. Like, we just wanted to feel everything back then. And I feel like that is very much true today. Let's take it from the top once
more with feeling. So over the nearly 30 years that you've been a band, and you've grown up and changed and taken on all these new projects and done these new things, do you feel like the sound of music that you're making has evolved and grown and changed? Or do you see a really clear through line from the OK Go of the late 90s to what you're putting out now on this album?
I definitely think if you look from album one to album five, we have certainly evolved. What's interesting, though, is that album five feels like a return to pre-album one or something like that. I mean, this actually feels like the most comfortable in our skin I think we've ever sounded in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think it's hard not to be conscious of trying to plant a flag when you're making art for a living. How are people going to listen to this? What are people going to think about this? What's it going to mean in culture? And this is the closest I've ever felt to, like, our flag was planted a long time ago, so we don't have anything we need to prove to anyone or show to anyone. It's just, here's what we make.
I totally agree. It's almost like we forgot that maybe we were supposed to prove anything. What a good, good
day it is. What a good, good day at last. Tim Nordwind and Damien Kulash of the band OK Go. In another part of the show, we'll hear about their decades of making elaborate one-take music videos. Their new album is called And the Adjacent Possible.
This is NPR News.
Her South Asian-inspired ice cream shop, Malai, is the star of Pooja Bavishi's new cookbook.
The goal was always to change the way that ice cream is perceived in this country. Why isn't it as typical and normal to pull a pint of masala chai from a grocery store freezer as it is a pint of cookies and cream?
A visit to one of her ice cream shops in Washington, D.C. on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Health Secretary RFK Jr. says he supports the measles vaccine.
He has also raised false doubts about vaccines.
That subtle way of, I encourage vaccination, but maybe it's not such a great idea. That's not how we do public health messaging.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. El Salvador's president says he won't be releasing a Maryland man back to the U.S. who was wrongly deported last month and sent to a notorious gang prison. His comments came while meeting with President Trump at the Oval Office today, along with several administration officials, including Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who pushed back on the Supreme Court order last week to facilitate the return of Kilmar Abrego Garcia. Rubio saying courts can't dictate foreign policy.
I can tell you this, Mr. President. No, the foreign policy of the United States is conducted by the President of the United States, not by a court. And no court in the United States has a right to conduct the foreign policy of the United States. It's that simple. End of story.
The Trump administration is entering uncharted territory for America's criminal justice system. President Trump asking El Salvador's leader to build more prisons, saying American citizens convicted of serious crimes could be next in line. Stocks rose today after the Trump administration granted a partial reprieve from some of its steep tariffs, especially on imports from China. NPR's Scott Horsley tells us Trump hinted that he may grant other carve-outs in the days to come.
iPhones and laptops made in China are getting a temporary break from President Trump's punishing new tariffs. The administration announced late Friday that electronic goods will not be subject to the 145% import tax applied to other Chinese products. The president also says he's considering suspending the 25% tariff on imported cars and car parts that he ordered less than 3 weeks ago. The news helped keep a relief rally going in the stock market, but it also adds to uncertainty about the size and shape of tariffs in the months and years to come. That uncertainty has left many businesses in limbo and reluctant to make big bets on an unpredictable economic future. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
And you're listening to NPR. A Nobel Prize-winning novelist and one of Latin America's most celebrated writers has died at the age of 89. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports.
Mario Vargas Llosa grew up in Peru writing poetry. He told WHYY's Fresh Air in 1988 that his father reacted by sending him to military school.
My father, as many middle-class people in Latin America in the 50s, thought that to be a writer was to be an eccentric, as someone marginal.
His debut 1963 novel depicted the corruption of that school and Peruvian society, themes he tackled in many essays, plays, and novels. Vargas Llosa ran for president of Peru in 1992 and won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 2010.
Tenemos que seguir soñando, leyendo y escribiendo.
We have to keep dreaming, reading, and writing, he said in his acceptance speech, to alleviate our mortal condition. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
A moderate earthquake struck Southern California today, rattling people in San Diego County and as far north as Los Angeles. The magnitude 5.2 quake was centered in the mountain town of Julian, just northeast of San Diego, which is known for its apple pie shops. No injuries or major damage was reported. Residents describing swaying lights, dishes falling off shelves, and being alerted just seconds before the quake hit. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From The Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. Nature.org/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Measles is an extremely contagious disease. It is also extremely preventable. There's a vaccine. It's highly effective. For decades, it has made measles outbreaks in the U.S. relatively rare, measles deaths rarer still. But the U.S. has now seen more than 700 cases of measles this year and 3 deaths. The federal response is now under scrutiny because the Health Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., has made a career of spreading false information about vaccines. So, what are this administration's views on vaccines, and what might they mean for what is already one of the worst U.S. measles outbreaks this century? For a view on that, I'm joined now by Dr. Peter Marks. Dr. Marks was the top vaccine regulator at the Food and Drug Administration until last month when he was forced out after clashing with Kennedy. Dr. Marks, welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
May I begin with what happened last month? You had been in this top vaccine job at the FDA since 2016. Why did you leave?
It wasn't an elective departure, but it was one that became clear that it was going to happen based on an accelerating number of events that seemed to be conspiring against vaccines in this country.
Can you briefly walk us through what you were not on board with that you saw happening?
We need to focus on what is in front of us right now in the world, which is right now we have outbreak of measles in the United States. We have other infectious diseases which are potentially preventable with vaccines. And we have vaccines for these infectious diseases that are both safe and effective.
May I want to get into everything that you're setting us up to discuss about vaccines, but I do have another question about the circumstances of your departure. The HHS put out a statement in which they said, if you do not want to get behind restoring science to its golden standard and promoting radical transparency, then he, meaning you, Dr. Marks, he has no place at FDA under the strong leadership of Secretary Kennedy, end quote. May I ask your response?
Yeah, so I'm happy to respond to that. Anybody who knows me knows that that is Orwellian speak, because they know that I am somebody that is guided by the science and that will follow the science in support of doing what is right. And in support of my Hippocratic oath as a physician. So I view that as something that I'd rather just move past, because dwelling on that is not going to help save the next child that's likely to die from measles in the next 2 to 4 weeks in the United States based on the current epidemic curve.
Let me focus us on these measles outbreaks. The epicenter is in Texas, in rural West Texas. How satisfied are you with the federal response?
I believe that the federal response has been tepid at best. It is not the type of forceful response that's necessary now that we have outbreaks of at least 3 cases in at least 7 jurisdictions. There are many other states that have isolated cases, and not every case is reported to CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And we estimate that the actual number of cases is probably roughly 5 times as many as has been reported to
CDC. So you're dealing, as ever, with imperfect data. What would a forceful response look like?
A forceful response involves going into the various states, working with the states to find the best way to get across the message for vaccination in that particular state. Because this particular vaccine has benefits that so greatly outweigh the risks. I need to say it as many times as I can. The vaccine doesn't kill children, the vaccine doesn't cause encephalitis, and the vaccine doesn't cause autism, okay? The vaccine has some transient, short-lived adverse effects in about 15 to 20 per 100,000. But compare that to 100 to 120 deaths per 100,000 children who get measles. And this is a remarkably a good vaccine.
Can but I we just jump in there? Because some of what you're saying is directly at odds with recent remarks by Secretary Kennedy. So I just want to line up what you're saying with what he has said and let you respond. I mean, Secretary Kennedy has said he supports the measles vaccine, that he's on the record in his confirmation hearing saying that. He has encouraged the public to get the vaccine. He has also said that the protection offered by the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella, that it wanes very rapidly. Is that true?
That's a false statement. Two doses of this vaccine provides essentially lifelong immunity. That kind of statement, as well as the statements about how the vaccine doesn't give good maternal transfer of antibodies to a neonate, as well as natural measles infection, those are just ways to discourage vaccination. And so that subtle way of, I encourage vaccination, but maybe it's not such a great idea. That's not how we do public health messaging.
Another point that Kennedy has made is talking about the benefits of infection. I'm referencing an interview he gave to Fox in which he said, you know, back in the day, everybody got measles. Measles gave you lifetime protection against measles infection, and the vaccine doesn't do that. Dr. Marks, your response.
Okay, so if we want to go back to a time when we got our drinking water from the same place that we put our sewage, we can go ahead and do that. But we have made tremendous public health advances. One of them is vaccination. Vaccines that we have that come through the FDA approval process in the United States have been determined to have benefits that greatly outweigh risks. Measles vaccine provides protection nearly lifelong against a virus that kills otherwise about 1 in 1,000 children who get the virus. So if we decide that we want everyone to get the measles so they have lifelong protection, it means that one child out of every 1,000 will die. Those are healthy children.
When and how do you see this current measles outbreak ending?
Well, I think what's probably going to happen is at some point after a few more children die, someone will really get activated and we will have the kind of robust public health response that we need. I hope that happens before too many children's lives are lost.
But you think that's what it's going to take? More children dying? It's such an awful thought.
I would have thought that after a second child died, we would have all been activated to do this. But it seems like because it's being normalized as well, children die of measles. This is something I truly worry about. And it actually keeps me up nights some because there is no reason in the United States for us to have a single child die of measles.
Dr. Peter Marks, he was, until last month, the top vaccine regulator at the Food and Drug Administration. Dr. Marks, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Just 1 in 10 Americans eat enough vegetables. For some, the challenge is the time it takes to prepare a salad or roast some broccoli. But a new TikTok trend makes eating veggies extremely simple. It's called Dinosaur Time. Sarah Bowden reports on whether this silly food hack can lead to healthier habits.
To do dinosaur time, you take a handful of plain leafy greens, give them a rinse, and then shove them in your mouth, perhaps while standing over your kitchen sink. Humans have been eating raw greens for millennia, but one of the first people to do this on TikTok seems to be a former science teacher named Amy Garrett.
I've been trying to eat more greens with every meal recently, and I have figured out like the best life hack for me that works for me, and so I thought I'd show you.
While she eats the greens, the Jurassic Park theme plays in the background. Garrett's TikTok handle is SAHMThingsUp, and she has nearly 50,000 followers. She often reminds them that dinosaur time is not a meal replacement or a way to lose weight. What it is a strategy to add leafy greens to your diet.
I think it's just so easy.
Emma Longshow of Boston says she's already polished off 3 bags of spinach because of dinosaur time and is eating her way through a fourth.
No cleanup, no meal prep needed. Helps with food waste.
Leafy greens are one of the healthiest foods you can eat. They're a rich source of fiber, vitamins K and C, calcium, iron, and research shows they can reduce the risk of certain cancers and heart disease. So who cares if you're getting all of these benefits while pretending to be a giant reptile?
So the first time I was thinking of that scene in Jurassic Park where they're seeing like the, I think it's like a brontosaurus, the like long neck one, where he's like chomping on the trees.
Longshow likes spinach and doesn't mind eating it plain before dinner of mac and cheese or a sandwich. For some people, that would taste disgusting. Which is okay, says Andrea Mathis, a registered dietitian in Alabama.
There are other ways that you can really enjoy spinach instead of eating it by the handfuls.
Mathis suggests blending spinach or kale into a smoothie. You might not even taste it. Or wrap up some leafy greens with lean turkey as a snack.
I also like to add them to omelets. And if you're making a sandwich, I like to substitute the lettuce for spinach leaves sometimes.
She says food should be enjoyable, and parents are sharing on TikTok that dinosaur time is a fun way to get kids to try new vegetables. That doesn't surprise Julie Stefanski, a registered dietitian in Pennsylvania.
Many children won't touch certain foods because it looks wet or how it feels.
And if kids don't want to touch a food, they're not going to eat it. But when pretending to be dinosaurs, kids are touching vegetables they might otherwise avoid, which is a win even if they don't end up eating anything. The important thing is they're exploring a new food.
Giving kids the space to do that on their own is so important in having, you know, a balanced diet.
Stefanski suspects that the popularity of dinosaur time will eventually go extinct. She suggests something that's nearly as easy is microwaving a bag of frozen veggies and throwing a little seasoning on top. But if you're like me and hate doing dishes, dinosaur time might be worth a try. Though I would not recommend starting with arugula, which I found to be a little spicy. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Bowden.
You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Baseball is the national pastime of Venezuela, but the sport has been hit hard by the country's long-running economic crisis and the increasingly authoritarian government. As John Otis reports, the latest sign of trouble was the mass defection of Venezuelan baseball players to Europe.
An under-23 Venezuelan baseball team was supposed to play tournaments last month in Italy and Spain. But after the team's manager fell ill and returned to Venezuela, 19 of his players suddenly showed up at a police station in Barcelona, where they petitioned for asylum.
Nosotros mismos tomamos nuestra propia decisión.
We made this decision on our own, one of the players, Herbert Gonzalez, said in a social media post. We hope Spain gives us the chance to fulfill our potential in the sport of baseball. Unlike Cuba, where defecting athletes must sneak out of the country, Venezuelan ballplayers can come and go as they please. Although the under-23 team is betting on Spain, most Venezuelan players try to pursue their dreams in the baseball mecca of the United States.
Acuña's got the big arm. The throw into third base is there waiting for him. They got him.
For decades, Venezuela has supplied major league teams with hundreds of players. Some become superstars, like Jose Altuve of the Houston Astros and Ronald Acuña Jr. He's the Atlanta Braves outfielder who in 2023 was named National League MVP and who often wows TV sportscasters.
Ronald Acuña Jr. is showing you why he might be the best player in baseball.
Still, the sport is feeling the pain of Venezuela's worst economic meltdown in history, a crisis that convinced nearly 8 million people to migrate overseas. 23 Major League Baseball teams used to operate training camps in Venezuela to groom local talent. But political instability, rising crime, and food shortages prompted them to relocate to the Dominican Republic.
Los que logran firmar tienen que pagarle.
Baseball writer Mari Montes says Venezuelan players who sign contracts with major league clubs come under pressure to give some of that cash to criminal gangs who threaten them and their families. Nicolas Maduro, Venezuela's authoritarian president, who's widely accused of stealing last year's election, is also throwing his weight around.
Que jugadores, grandes ligas,
Montes says that when Venezuelan players, even big leaguers, express support for the country's opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, they have received threatening messages from Maduro cronies.
Be quiet, be silent, don't talk about Maduro's regime, don't talk about Maria Corina.
NPR reached out to Maduro's press office, but there was no response.
Grande por la parte izquierda se va.
Yet for all of its problems, Venezuela still produces more big leaguers than any other foreign country except for the Dominican Republic.
Surgieron más que nunca una cantidad de academias privadas increíbles.
One reason, says TV sportscaster Ignacio Serrano, is that scores of Venezuelan-run baseball training camps have sprung up to replace those shut down by major league clubs. Serrano also points to another factor.
Remember, baseball is a national pastime, but also a way to run away from the poverty.
Indeed, just like the under-23 team in Spain, legions of Venezuelan youngsters see baseball as a means of escape. For NPR News, I'm John Otis.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain Podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. And today's story comes from Ashley Bloss. When Bloss was 7 years old, her mother died. Nearly 30 years later, in 2023, Bloss decided to fly to Chicago to visit her mother's grave for the first time since the funeral. She reserved a ride with a car service to get to the cemetery, and that morning, a sleek black car with tinted windows pulled up to her hotel, driven by a man in a suit. When they got to the cemetery, Bloss began to look for her mother's grave, and the driver stood near the car, giving her space.
I'm just kind of wandering through the cemetery, and I look up at the driver, and he's looking at me, and he could tell that I was getting more and more distressed. And so I look down and all of a sudden I'm standing on my mother's grave. I could see her name, and the driver, he calls out, he said, "Did you find it?" And I just start sobbing. And I'm trying to choke through my tears and tell him, "Yes, I found it." And so he runs over with a box of tissue and he looks down at it and he notices that the gravestone was covered. You know, you could see that it was a little bit overgrown because it had just been there for such a long time. And so he just dropped to his knees immediately and starts digging at the grass and the dirt, and he is just clawing away at it, trying to reveal the entire stone. And when I found it, I had only was only able to see my mother's name and her date of birth and date of death, but he was so kind as to really clean that stone so that I could it revealed that it said beloved mother of Angela and Ashley, Angela being my sister. And that is when I really just started sobbing very, very hard. Once he cleans off and clears this grave, he walks away back to the car and allows me to have the time that I really felt like I needed. I will never forget that moment of humanity, and I'll never forget seeing this really kind individual. You know, it didn't matter that he was in his full suit, wiping the grave away with his hand. He just helped me through that moment. And so I will never forget his kindness. And I think he's my unsung hero.
Ashley Bloss lives in Columbia, South Carolina. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Drexel University, whose model of experiential education allows students to choose their own path and explore the world, enabling them to discover their perfect career. More at drexel.edu.
Today, you can find Korean-Mexican fusion food across the country, but the Korean barbecue beef taco can trace its popularity to one man, Roy Choi.
You can't take your eye off this. You have to be fully engaged, because the difference between delicious and burnt is minuscule.
I get in the kitchen with the legendary chef and hear all about his new cookbook tomorrow on All Things Considered. Just turn on your radio or ask your phone or smart speaker to play NPR or your local member station by name.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Total Wine and More, for discovering something new like a Cabernet or single barrel bourbon, learn more at totalwine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina, available to adults 21 or older. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Swing with the jive, brother. Come on and swing with the jive, brother. Come on and swing with the jive, brother. Yes, you got to come on with the jumping with the jive, brother. You got to jump in with the jive, brother. You got to jump in with the jive, brother. Yes, you got to come on with the come on. Up the kicky, pop a riddle and the keep a rattle against the skip to the yard. Up the kicky, put it to the side, bro. Put